So let's pretend you are starting to write a book of your life story. Where would you start? Does your story start with the day you were born, or with your parents or grandparents? Who are the other important people in your story? What events and experiences would you include, the ones most shaped who you are as a person, and might explain the choices you have made in your life? And when a stranger finished reading your story, what would they say you are like as a person? How would they describe you and what you cared most about? Would they say you are resourceful and resilient because of the adversities you have overcome? Would they say you are caring and kind and loyal because of the way you gave of yourself to others and carried your friendships? As of last year, my story got a bit more interesting. My dad's family always thought we were Cantonese because my grandfather left Canton as a teenager and moved to Hong Kong when his dad died. In my dad's apartment in Hong Kong, there's a piece of photocopy paper stuck on his living room cabinet. It was given to him by his cousin when they all hired a bus and took a field trip to the ancestral village. It's the origin story of our clan from the old village records. It turns out we're not Cantonese. The paper says, in the style of archaic Chinese poetry, there was an official who came from the capital to Canton with his four sons. He stayed and homesteaded there, one son in each direction. And that's apparently how our last name came to be in Canton. Last year, this came up in conversation over family dinner, and my cousin and I decided to chase down this story. So, to make a long story short, we found out the name of that official, because the same story appeared in the biography of a famous person with my last name, a famous person who may very well turned out to be my grandfather's first cousin. That official's name who came to Canton is Sun Cheng Di. He was an official in the emperor's court in the 1200s China, which is considered a time of cultural and scientific flourishing, a sort of cultural renaissance. Gunpowder, paper money, and movable type was invented then, as well as advances in farming and engineering. A list of prominent people with my last name in Wikipedia includes the guy who wrote The Art of War, and a lot of scholars and librarians and court advisors. So, I come from a very long line of heady people who love books. The official was sent to quash a peasant rebellion. But soon after, the empire was invaded by the Mongols. He was out of a job and decided to stay. It's weird to suddenly feel a connection to someone who goes back to 13th century China. Especially, I've never even met my grandfather, who died when he was my age now. Connecting my story to this court official has extended my story way beyond my own parents. I find myself for the first time feeling more Chinese than ever. My place in the world feels different now that my story reaches back 800 years. Something else weird happened. I was buddies with these brothers in high school, who have the same last name as I do in Chinese, but they spell it differently in English. Around the time when I discovered my 800-year-old ancestor, I happened to have dinner with one of the brothers, and I asked him if he knew anything about his family history, especially since they were born in Canada. After I told them about my grandfather's possible famous cousin, he said, well, funny thing, his grandfather had told them back in their ancestral village, when the family visit the family gravesite, that famous person is there visiting the next grave with all his bodyguards. It turns out we may be long-lost cousins, and we had no idea for all the years we've been friends. Our stories can connect us when we find things in common like an ancestor, or they can keep us apart if there's a historic grudge like between the French and English. Who we think we are comes from our stories and the way we tell them. They anchor us in time and history and give color and texture to the way we think and feel about ourselves. And the bigger and older our stories, the more people we find ourselves connected to, like the many branches of an oak growth tree, all tracing back to the same thick trunk. As we read on today in Romans chapters 5-8, we find Paul taking his readers back to the Genesis story, to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Paul wrote this letter to try and heal a rift in the church in Rome between the Jewish Christians and the non-Jewish Christians, because as far back as anyone can remember, the Jewish people considered anyone not Jewish as the other people they should have nothing to do with. That us and them approach in the world would make church really weird, if not impossible. Especially when Paul understands the gospel to be about an alternative kingdom to the Roman Empire, where every kind of people in the world are brought together to become a family as the people of God. So Paul starts by reminding them what Jesus' gospel is about, how everyone in the church needs God the same way, how they all become part of God's family the same way. It's a gift from God facilitated by Jesus' rescue mission. Now, Paul takes these separate stories of the Jewish and non-Jewish people, and he's about to trace them back to the thick trunk in the bigger story in Genesis that began in the Garden of Eden. Because if they're going to get along, they need a bigger story to belong to than just their own branches. Paul is about to reveal to the Jewish and non-Jewish Christians that they're actually cousins, all traced back to the same thick trunk of the same tree. Chapter 5, verse 12, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people, because all sinned. Chapter 6, verse 3, don't you know that all of us who were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? We were therefore buried with him through baptism into death, in order that, just as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, we too may live a new life. Verse 6, for we know that our old self was crucified with him, so that the body ruled by sin might be done away with, and we should no longer be slaves to sin. Because anyone who has died has been set free from sin. As Paul wrote this, this may have been the moment when non-Jewish people first found themselves included in the Genesis story. That Genesis was not just a Jewish story about how the Jewish God made the Jewish people, but it's the beginning of all of our stories. How the one true God creator made the entire cosmos. That Adam wasn't just the first man of the Jewish family tree, but the first man of all family trees. Okay, you may be going, duh, because we now take this for granted. But it occurred to me that there was a time before Jesus, before Paul, Genesis was just a Jewish story. The next thing that happened in our universal origin story is how our ancestors in the garden decided to leave God and his garden and strike out on their own. They thought life would be better, freer without God. Instead, their lives got messy, conflicted, and painful. The more pain they experienced, the more it collected and festered into a dark side in them. The compulsion to hurt people back for the way they have been hurt. Very quickly, violence became a way to solve problems. And the way to survive is to carry a bigger stick than the other guy. This is not the life God made humans to live. Life became smaller and more suffocating, and the human soul became slave to our own dark nature. Adam and Eve made a decision that took humanity off course. This is the biblical meaning of sin. They hit the golf ball into the weeds. They can't find the ball and are no longer playing on the course. Paul compares this lost ball human condition to slavery, which in the Roman Empire is the epitome of systemic powerlessness. Once someone becomes a slave, there are a few paths that lead to freedom. Not for him, not for his children and their children. Why Jesus came and what Jesus did, Paul says, was to give himself to pay off all our slave contracts. Jesus did what our slave masters demanded so we could get our life back. We got to start over with a blank slate. It's all possibilities going forward with no one chasing us. We were finally free to have a life. About 50 years after Paul wrote Romans, Hadrian became the emperor of Rome. His first act as emperor was to execute the four senators who didn't vote for him. This was a blatant overreach of power, and it made the Senate very angry. Since Hadrian didn't feel safe to hang around Rome, he decided to travel around the empire. Then he decided to build a summer villa in the north in the town of Tivoli. Hadrian considered himself something of an amateur architect. He wanted to build something that would showcase all the best things he saw and loved from traveling around the empire. His little villa was going to be a miniature model of the greatness of Rome. He found a little property, actually 250 acres of land. He planned out all the buildings, all magnificent, covered with the best materials from the ends of the empire. Egyptian granite and marble and columns 40 feet tall carved from a single piece of stone. When archaeologists excavated the place, they discovered an extensive network of underground tunnels. They realized, underneath the grand extravagant surroundings of where the emperor lived and entertained, was where the nameless slaves scurried and moved around to do the work that supported the life of that one man in luxury. The slaves did all the work, but they were not to be seen because they don't matter. The tunnels led to an apartment building in the back. This turned out to be the slave quarters. That building had 500 rooms. They estimated with about 10 to a room, there were 5,000 slaves who served the whim of this one man. These were not just servants and cooks, but also doctors and accountants and musicians and artists. They were all the people who did all the work, but didn't matter. They only existed for the emperor, the one person who did matter. In the Roman Empire, you could go shopping for slaves the way we go buy a car, and the way we may flip cars when a better model comes along. The average upper-class family had at least one, but typically 5 to 6 if they could afford it. The emperor had 5,000 just at a summer villa. There were a lot of slaves in Rome and the empire, somewhere between 30 to 40% of the population. They were the engine that kept the economy and life going for the lucky few. And the way you get so many people to mindlessly submit and keep their heads down and just do what they're told is to take away their sense of self and self-worth. To make a human into a slave, you convince them their life is not theirs. They're not entitled to choice. They have no identity, no worth. They exist to serve their master. Do you watch those TV genealogy shows? For the celebrity guests with African ancestry, the stories almost always evaporate 150 years back if their ancestors were slaves on a plantation. Because nobody wrote their real names down in family records. Many just appear generically as numbers, slave 1, slave 2, and so on. The moment when they were enslaved, all personal information identity was erased, because they don't matter, and nobody cared. If you live downstairs in the tunnels of Hadrian's villa, nobody cares about your story, the one you're writing about you, because nobody cares about you. You probably don't even have time to think about you, let alone write it down. And you probably don't know what even to write since you don't have much of a life to write about. The guy upstairs only cares about the thing he needs you to do, so he doesn't have to do it. And if that thing doesn't get done, you can be replaced. We met the slave Onesimus in Paul's letter to Philemon. His name means useful, but I don't think it's a compliment. His name describes what he's good for, all he's good for. The person himself is invisible and is of no relevance. Some of the slaves in the Roman Empire were victims of war. Some others were victims of bad luck. They found themselves in debt and had no way out except to sell themselves into service. This happened a lot, in part because of very high taxes. One historian says when the Christmas story says the emperor declared all the world should be taxed, it was not a little detailed of a story, but the description of the Roman way of life. In the Roman system, the rich were somehow exempt from taxes, so they would offer to lend money in exchange for the poor man's land and service. This was a financial hole very difficult to dig out of, both for him and his children and their children. Which brings us to the other way someone became a slave in Rome. They were born into it. This is the analogy Paul is making about our humanity. When Adam walked out away from God, he took all of his descendants with him and distanced himself from the one being who cared about protecting his dignity, his worth, and his identity as a human being. Without God and the protection in his garden habitat, human beings became vulnerable to mean masters who didn't care about us and only wanted to exploit us. And over time, we lost sense of who we were. So back in chapter 1, Paul explains how humanity came into our spiritual amnesia. When he says humans have lost connection with our Creator and instead filled that void with man-made idols. Humans worship things that rob us of our worth and identity as God's masterpieces and enslave us to act out destructively. I think the dark side in us comes from the lifetime of pain we bottle up inside us. When we don't have a way to make peace with the ways we have suffered, we will lash out to hurt the people around us when the pain spills over. And that's not the life God made us to live. Jesus sets us free from being controlled by our dark side, Paul says. But now what? Once we get our lives back, how do we go about rediscovering who we are? And how do we use our freedom when we have never had choice before? In the empire, there are really only two models for life. You're either in the emperor class or you're in the slave class. The emperor lives for himself. He only cares about himself. He gets to boss other people around. The slaves get bossed around. They live to do what the emperor says. So when and if a slave ever gets their freedom, they're still in danger of continuing to live the life of a slave if they continue to think like a slave. Before long, they would just find a new master if they don't figure out how to live free. When the Roman Empire became weak and started losing power, many of the people the Romans oppressed went to work for German barbarians for protection. The slaves traded one master for another because they couldn't imagine a free life. This is Paul's point. If we don't know what to do with the freedom Jesus got us, we will be holding ourselves to some master because that's the only life we know. If our world only has emperors and slaves, and if we don't want to stay slaves, we might strive to become mini emperors. Instead of serving some other emperor, we will become our own boss of us. So, if you have met your dark side, let me ask, do we trust ourselves to be boss of ourselves and still do right by the people around us? Paul says in chapter 7, verse 21, I find this law at work. Although I want to do good, evil is right there with me, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within me. What a wretched man I am, who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death. He's saying he wouldn't trust himself to be his own emperor. A person who only cares about himself like the emperor is called a narcissist. Here's a description. Narcissists are overly focused on themselves and lack empathy for others, which means that they cannot see another person's perspective. They also feel entitled to special privileges and believe they are superior to other people. As a result, narcissists are bad relationship partners and can be difficult to work with. Narcissists are also more likely to be hostile, feel anxious, compromise their health, and fight with friends and family. So, emperors don't do well in relationships. The person who wrote this goes on to describe what happens when we can't figure out who we need to be, if neither emperor or slave is the model of a good life. We're paralyzed by not knowing who we really are. Instead of having well-defined identities, we have a churning sea of conflicting feelings and desires inside us. When we don't know who we are, we find it difficult to know what we should be doing. We may have the right qualifications, we may have the skills and talents, but often we fear we will make the wrong decisions about our futures. When we don't know who we are, we become slaves to our feelings. It turns out being our own emperors might just be another form of slavery. So we badly need another model for a well-lived life. Civilization that is civilized, strike some kind of balance between my needs as my own person and our needs as a community. The problem, as Paul says, is that we all have some idea of what is good, but for some reason can't do it. And instead, we always end up back on a path that destroys relationships. This is maybe the struggle we are seeing played out around us. We're free, even from God. But now we have to figure out who we are. But how? Based on what? And what is the model of how to live a meaningful life besides becoming mini emperors or being free slaves, still living as slaves? In the 30s, an up-and-coming American philosopher was raking leaves in his yard when a well-dressed stranger approached him and asked him to give a good reason for him to keep on living. The guy had everything of a good life, but these things didn't make him happy. A philosopher didn't have an answer, so he ended up writing a bunch of famous people, including Gandhi, and asking them why modern life feels like a lifeless vacuum. A popular comedian in our time says about the same thing on a talk show. He says this: underneath everything in your life, there is this thing that empty, forever empty. That knowledge that it's all for nothing and that you're alone. It's down there. And sometimes when things clear away, you're not watching anything, you're not in your car, and you start going, oh no, here it comes, that I'm alone. It starts to visit on you, just the sadness. Life is tremendously sad just by being in it. In a survey, a quarter of Americans say they don't have a strong sense of what makes their lives meaningful. Is this why, in the modern world, with our abundance of things, we're struggling with loneliness and depression and opioids? The pandemic has been hard on the most healthy of us, but it has been outright devastating for people who were already struggling with inner tyrants. This tweet appeared on my wall. I need to get honest because it's eating me up inside. I've relapsed multiple times in the last 8 to 12 weeks, mostly with pot, but on two occasions, I tried to get enough of a substance to OD on. It didn't work. I'm happy it didn't. I burned through the savings I finally built up, and I'm faced with bills right now I don't know how I'll pay. This is not a plea for help. I don't want and definitely don't deserve anything at this point. I've asked for help too often. I just want to be honest. I'm 4 days sober today. It's all I have to be proud of, but it's enough. The human race needs desperately to rediscover our worth and identity, and what big story our little stories connect to that may give us a reason to keep getting out of bed in the morning and keep fighting for our lives. And maybe we need help from someone who is willing to help us with that fight. For the Jewish people, the word slavery inevitably evokes the memory of the Exodus story. It's their most important story as a people. How God heard the ancestors cry out suffering as slaves in Egypt. How God sent Moses to challenge the Pharaoh and won them freedom. But slaves one day and free people the next, they had the same problem. Who are they now that they are free? How did they figure that out? And what are they to do with their freedom? When Paul says in chapter 6, verse 3, that Christian baptism is like dying with Jesus, the image of water recalls the Jewish people crossing the Red Sea. There they left their oppressors and their slave life behind in the water and crossed over to a new life as a free people. On the other side of the waters, God gave them the Torah, the Ten Commandments as a kind of compass on how to use freedom in a way that is good for their relationship with God, good for their own sense of well-being, and good for their neighbor. On the other side of the waters, God gifted them with land so they would be landowners, a free people who enjoy the dignity of meaningful work with the land God gave them. And God also gave them a purpose, to use the freedom to make blessing and be a people of blessing, to balance self-interest and the greater good that makes life better for everybody. The Exodus story brought 12 competing tribes together and united them into a people. It told them who they were and all the life that they get to live, not just making mud bricks, but artisans created by God in His image, loved by God, and living with God and each other in peace. With the church in Rome cracking apart along racial lines, they needed a bigger story, one big enough to include everybody. So in a bold move, Paul folded the non-Jewish people into the Jewish origin story. So not just Jewish people, but every human being is loved by God and made in His image. And Paul inaugurated a new Exodus story, where our baptism is our new Red Sea crossing into a new life with a blank slate. And we unite ourselves behind Jesus as our King, who gives us a third model for life. A King who, unlike the emperor, does not treat us as slaves, but calls us friends. A King willing to do what's good for His people, even at the point of personal sacrifice. This is a story God gives us to begin us rediscovering our identity. We are incredibly important and valuable to the Creator God who made us. In a children's story, The Little Prince, he leaves his planet behind to explore other worlds, leaving behind his garden and in particular one special rose. When the little prince comes upon a rose garden on Earth, he finds himself strangely sad, missing his special rose back home, which puzzles him since he's surrounded by roses. A wise fox explains to him, that rose is not just another rose out of many. It's the time you spend on your rose that makes your rose so important. You become responsible forever for what you've tamed. You're responsible for your rose. So the little prince says to the rose garden, you're lovely, but you're empty. One couldn't die for you. Of course, an ordinary passerby would say, my rose looked just like you. But my rose, all on her own, is more important than all of you together, since she's the one I've watered. The stories in Genesis and Exodus used to inform the Jewish people the reason they were so important to God. They were the ones He watered. But it turns out they weren't the only ones the story was for. Every human being was there in Adam when God gave him life. We're all the ones God watered. That's why Jesus is invested in our well-being and freedom. It's why He's willing to give us life, so we can live free and stay free. And He offers us a spirit to walk with us as we figure out our God-given worth and identity, and as we figure out how to use our freedom for the good of all the world. If you choose to keep thinking about your story this week, do celebrate you, because you can, and because you and your life and everything in your life matter. You matter to us, to God, and you should matter to you too. And our stories matter, because it connects to the bigger story of being made in the image of God, being rescued by Jesus from slavery, from our destructive nature, and with the Spirit's help, recover and reclaim our identity and dignity as the children of the Creator God. And as you think about your story, think about what you are doing with your freedom. Because if we remember what it feels like to be enslaved, we would naturally become champions of freedom for others. Remember Onesimus from Philemon? His encounter with Christianity through his master awoke something in him that made him run away to find freedom. After Paul's intervention pleading for Onesimus to be forgiven and set free, Onesimus went into a life of service for the church, eventually becoming a bishop. St. Patrick, the guy we drink green beer for every March, has a similar story. He was a teenager living on the edge of the Roman Empire in Britain around the 400s, a time when the Roman Empire was very weak. One day, Irish pirates raided his town, and he was captured and taken to Ireland as a slave. Even though he came from a very religious family, he never really thought much about God, until now. He was a slave in a Druid family that worshipped strange gods, practiced cannibalism, and human sacrifices. And in his autobiography, he described how he recited prayers he learned as a child as he did his work to get his mind off the awful realities of his life. This went on for 6 years, until one night in a dream, he heard a voice telling him to run away, that there was a ship waiting to take him home. He did what the voice told him, and after a 200-mile trek on foot, he came to a port where a merchant ship captain on his way to Britain reluctantly agreed to take him home. Patrick got his life back. He was free. What he did next was amazing. He decided to study to become a priest, hardly my idea of making up for lost time. And by his 40s, he was ordained a bishop. I imagine he could have settled into his career and have a pretty comfortable life. But he couldn't stop thinking about the women and children caught up in slavery in Ireland. He would have dreams of slaves reaching out for him and calling out to him. So he asked to be sent back to Ireland as a missionary. He became the first human being in history to speak out against slavery. One historian writes, "He worries constantly for his people, not just for their spiritual, but for their physical welfare. The horror of slavery was never lost on him. In becoming an Irishman, Patrick wedded his world to theirs, his faith to their life." For the Roman Church of the first 5 centuries, baptism, the mystical water ceremony in which the naked catechumen dies to sin, was the foundation of a Christian life. Patrick found a way of swimming down to the depths of the Irish psyche and warming and transforming Irish imagination, making it more humane and more noble while keeping it Irish. No longer were baptismal waters be the only effective sign of a new life in God. New life was everywhere, in rank abundance, and all of God's creation was good. And in his own words, Patrick says, "But it is the women kept in slavery who suffer the most, and who keep their spirits up despite the menacing and terrorizing they must endure. The Lord gives grace to his many handmaids, and though they are forbidden to do so, they follow Jesus with backbone." We are watching a generation on the street fighting for change for themselves and others. What I think they're also doing is pressing all of us to clarify who we are as a civilization, what we stand for, and exposing our need for the world to be better and fairer for everybody. They want some better news than what they're getting, a bigger story that is more inclusive and has room for everybody to be family. Jesus' gospel offers us the biggest and oldest story to belong to. It's a story of the God who made human beings with all the worth and dignity that our relationship with him carries. Human beings who are loved by God so much so that Jesus gives us life so we can have our lives back from whatever tyrant who had taken them away from us. And whatever we want to invest our freedom in to bless the earth and the people in it, God gives us every resource we need to replant the garden he has watered. I'd like to finish by praying parts of the prayer of St. Patrick, a prayer reaching out for the God who loves us so much, he wouldn't leave us on our own, the God whose story includes us in it, and at this moment is with us and all around us, breathing into us the life we need. I arise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. I arise today through the strength of Christ's birth with his baptism, through the strength of his crucifixion with his burial, through the strength of his resurrection with his ascension, through the strength of his descent for the judgment of doom. I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's ear to hear me, God's words to speak for me, God's hand to guide me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to protect me, God's host to save me from snares of devils, from temptation of vices, from everyone who shall wish me ill, afar and anear, alone and in multitude. Christ with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, Christ when I lie down, Christ when I sit down, Christ when I rise, Christ in the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks of me, Christ in every eye that sees me, Christ in every ear that hears me. I arise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. Amen.